about religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Hive Mind. Today is November the 19th, 2021. I'm your host, Nate Kapp. Welcome to the 52nd Cubbyhole Podcast, where important topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. The website for this show is cubbyhole.com. That's cubbyhole.com. You can now listen to this podcast on Spotify, Apple, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, Minds.com, Amazon Music, Odyssey, YouTube, and much more. Today, we have Douglas Martin back on the show. How you doing, Doug?
Doing real good. How you doing, Nathan?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for coming on today. It has definitely been a while.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So before we go any further into this show, I just want to give a quick overview of the last episode, number 51, where I took us into the Fellowcraft degree of Esoteric Freemasonry. And in that show, I basically covered the porch of Solomon's Temple with the pillars, the terrestrial and celestial pillars, plus I also covered the knowledge of natural law, just a basic understanding of natural law that really must be understood by the student before passing on the porch through the pillars. And I gave a brief description of the winding staircase, the 3, the 5, and the 7, including the 3 tools, on the first three steps, the first 3 degrees, which is the square, the level, and the plumb rule. And then on the and then up towards the middle of the staircase is the 5 steps, which is the 5 senses, which the student must master to be able to see beyond, especially be able to see the hidden realm, see beyond the physical. And then the 7 liberal arts, including the trivium and quadrivium, which teaches big world picture thinking and especially critical thinking. And towards the end, I broke down the square and compass symbol with the capital letter G in the middle. And I also gave a little powerful word at the very end, a green language word. So lots to ruminate on and contemplate.
What was the word?
The word was Jesus.
Oh, yeah, I love that. That was great.
And so there's lots more to come on the second degree. And if you have anything you wanted to say on any of that, please feel free.
Well, I wanted to commend you. You've been doing a fantastic job laying it out, and I'm very impressed. I see a major improvement in the show in general, and you're doing a fantastic job. I definitely feel a strong need to be there on the front line there helping to hash that out with you, and that's what I'm here to try to do. But yeah, Freemasonry and understanding the esoteric Freemasonry is one of the most important things that we can accomplish in a lifetime, and most people never seem to have achieved it, and that includes people that have joined the brick-and-mortar lodge systems, and it's a concern, and I think you're doing a fantastic job laying that out. You know, we're laying the foundations for understanding the deeper aspects of esoteric knowledge and lost knowledge and lost history, so it's a difficult task, you're doing a really great job laying the foundations. Sometimes it feels like, you know, maybe that the walls are closing in to the point where we don't have time to fully lay it all out, because this tyranny is accelerating at an exponential curve or an exponential rate.
Right.
And the foundations have to be laid. We have, you know, for me, I mean, I just want to tell you that I learned natural law. And that was the key that I picked up and took into the darkness of antiquity and went into the anthropology with that key and tried to take it further and recover as much as what had been lost in the history of Egypt as well as the mystery schools themselves. And I do feel that there's enough information now that is available that we can solve this problem. But I don't think that enough people understand the breadth of that information and the magnitude of that information, and they haven't put it in focus to discern what is the most important information. But I laid out in my new presentation what I felt were the most important authors. So I'm hoping that people will start to look into those authors and understand that most people don't really understand what's going on, because there's a lot more involved than what they've even learned or considered in many cases. And it's only when we get into the sublime information that we're going to discover what's really eluding most people. So
we haven't heard you talk anything about the Seed Conference, so I definitely want to hear that. But one of the things that, if people aren't familiar with your presentation that you gave at the Seed Conference, it's titled The Origins of Secret Societies Part 2. And I'd like to, well, first of all, let's hear what you have to say, or what you thought about the Seed Conference. I've really been wanting to hear that on air, so, and I'm sure a lot of other people do too.
Yeah, I've been wanting to talk about it, and I'm glad to be back on here with you talking about it, or with the opportunity to talk about it. So we pulled it off, you know, and there were definitely some technical glitches, but the autonomy team pulled us through, and without their help, I don't think we could have pulled it off. But
right,
that's why we had that contingency. And I'd like to say that the next conference that we could figure out a way to pull it off without the autonomy team. Not that we don't want them involved, but this, we want to get our technical game up to speed. But yeah, I mean, I'm very pleased with the way it came off. I'm definitely blown away by the information that was presented. I was very pleased with the speakers that participated, and their material was superb. And I've never even participated or even been to a conference that had material that was on par, and everything complemented everything else, and everything was part of the same message. I've never seen anything like that, and I certainly have never been a part of anything like that. So in that way, I felt that it was a monumental success.
I agree.
The technicals were the biggest issue, and there were some. I really, quite frankly, was not prepared to host, because I didn't expect to be hosting. I was there to pick up the ball if somebody dropped the ball, and I did the best I could with it. And in retrospect, I realized I could have been a hell of a lot more prepared.
Same.
I did not expect to basically carry the whole conference, but I don't have a problem with it, and I'm not complaining, because it was a great experience for me, and ended up in the Q&A with Passio, basically hosting a whole show there. That was an experience of a lifetime. I've always wanted to do that, and I hope to do it again soon.
Yeah, I couldn't be there. I got kicked out. I didn't have a way back in. Zoom just knocked me out, and I couldn't Well, that's all right.
I saw the look on your face. I could tell you were probably just about done.
Yeah, I was pretty bummed, but whatever. It was cool just listening to you guys and you guys.
I think we were both exhausted at that point.
Yeah, for sure.
That was about 30 hours into it. But no, you did a fantastic job, and you've been doing a great job on your Cubbyhole platform there, and I'm glad to be a part of that. I want to give you some more material, and I intend to make up for some lost time here, but the conference itself was awesome, and we were concerned, thinking that Brandon wasn't going to get his presentation in time, and he did, and it was an awesome one, and a good lengthy one, too. And some of the other speakers I had been unfamiliar with, and they definitely impressed. So I was very pleased with the cooperation on everybody's part. And there's a lot of things I would like to have gone smoother. But overall, there's nothing else to compare it to, because there's no conferences that I know of that have that hard hitting of a message.
Right.
You know, now, and then as far as my own work is concerned, it's taken everything I had to just bring the what I understand about the chronology that was lost in Egypt and the science that was taught in the mystery schools. And that's been what my focus has been on. But I have a lot of other knowledge. And now that I have some of that finally, you know, documented, That's you know, I'm ready to talk about some of the other things that I've negated to discuss in the past. But I think that ultimately, if we really want a solution, we're, you know, I just can't see leaving that off the table, because it has to be dealt with. And, you know, I mean, it's such a huge weight off my shoulders to get that on the table. But And I understand that it's going to take time for people to fully understand what it means. And it's advanced in that sense, but it's not meant to be out of reach.
Right.
I did this work because once I began to understand it, I began to understand that the problems that we're faced with today are essentially the same problems that we've had for the last, you know, 50,000 years. And we can certainly say since the Greeks, or since the beginning of history, we have the same dilemma. And the dilemma is that we don't understand the ancient expression of the Egyptians. And the reason that's so important is because the knowledge that we're talking about took so long to develop and understand. Once it had been lost, it's potentially not recoverable. So
yeah, that was something that you said in your presentation that I felt had so much value, where you said that, you know, any place that a secret can easily be destroyed is not worth knowing, in regards to the pyramids and constellations. Is that something you can explain for the audience, what you meant by that?
Yeah, basically, you know, the ancients are one reason that people, I think, don't understand why the pyramids were built is because they don't have a concept of an entire civilization united in its task.
Right.
So they have no concept of the amount of time it would take to complete a project like that, and an entire civilization being devoted for that amount of time to complete a project like that. So trying to paint the picture that temple was accomplished in the span of a single lifetime, I think that's part of the fallacy. So, you know, we have plenty of evidence to show that the later Egyptian temples, which are mostly solar in their origin, but there are some lunar temples still remaining, but not very many. But there's a lot more solar temples, but we can see there's clear evidence, for instance, at Luxor, that temple had been built in different stages by different generations. So each or different, each section of Luxor were built on, or it was expanded. So the point I'm trying to make is that temple was not built in a single lifetime, and that it was the accomplishment of multiple generations. And then the pyramids are the grandest example of that. So trying to have a feasible concept of how those were completed in a single lifetime, I don't think you'll ever find an answer to that, because that's not possible and that's not what took place. But I guess the emphasis I'm trying to put on is an entire civilization united in its task, and its task to build the grandest temple to the great architect of the universe, and as a repository of time and measurement, and to store all of the knowledge, the sum total of the knowledge that they had up to that point. But see, it's knowledge that deals with how we discover and harmonize with the laws in nature. So this is a body of knowledge that can't afford to be squandered or lost. And when we consider man's ambition to dominate nature, then we start to understand the reasons how the original wisdom could become a nuisance, because that would be negative interference from man's ambition. Like the idea of the Christ, Jesus was said to be, you know, the divine incarnation of the great spirit. But yet on the ground, he was seen as negative interference.
Mm.
So the way I like to say that is that, he was murdered so people could get back to their bill worship.
Mm-hmm.
Or he was murdered so people could get back to their immoral behavior, which is the religion of statism and the religion of money, or serving three or four masters. I mean, I always think of it as the need for the protection of the state is the need for the protection for immoral behavior. And we'll talk about that. We'll get into orthodoxy. Because the whole idea of a republic, for instance, is that we have a certain set of ideals, and then we're going to annex a certain territory and have an imaginary boundary there. And inside of that territory, we are going to defend an orthodoxy that's defined by a code of law. So that's the idea of a republic, is that we enshrine inalienable rights, and those rights cannot be compromised. So it's a fail-safe for a democracy, for instance.
Hmm.
The idea that democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner. Democracy is mob rule, which means rule by the most ignorant. So the idea of a republic is to enshrine certain inalienable rights, and that's an orthodoxy, and that is the protection or the failsafe for a potential democracy where we can allow average citizens or a slave class to participate in affairs of the state without risking having our inalienable rights compromised. So the Greek democracy, or the democracy is a Greek ideal, and the republic is a Roman ideal. Both these ideas, of course, are older. We know the idea of a republic comes from Sumer and the Code of Hammurabi, and it's older than that even. But the point is where classical history picks up, we are introduced to democracy as a Greek ideal and the idea of a republic as a Roman ideal. And the republic represents the orthodoxy, and the democracy represents the liberal in the sense of open to interpretation or potential to innovate. So that can be a threat to the republic through revisionism and The whole point I'm making is the Republic is a fail-safe for democracy, but it's also a fail-safe to enshrine inalienable rights. So the term conservative means orthodoxy, and that's a typically associated with the idea of the Republic. Yeah, and we'll keep talking about this. So just that's one thing I want to do is just keep this going until we make sure that we're satisfied with what we've discussed.
Right. Yeah, you actually just answered a question that I already had. So that's very...
Well, the other question that you asked about the secrecy, you know, the idea was they built the pyramids to store knowledge in a structure that was so robust it couldn't be destroyed. And then before that, they had venerated in the cosmos where it absolutely cannot be destroyed, could still be recovered even if it had been lost. That was the idea.
Right.
That was the contingency for lost knowledge. So the idea of putting knowledge in something delicate that could easily be destroyed is a fallacy, or it's just, it's kind of erroneous thinking. I mean, something like that could only be serving man's ambition, because the whole point about lost knowledge, yeah, there was knowledge in the past that was held back. The Aten is a good example, and we can talk about that. But that's advanced. The point I'm making, though, is the dilemma that humankind is faced with is how do we teach the ignorant masses these advanced sciences? And then how do we teach academia the lost expression of these sciences? Because academia wants to scoff and mock the mythology because they don't understand that it's an expression of the science. And without the science, we can't survive in this world as a species.
So speaking of the Republic and democracy, usually the Republic is associated with Christianity, and democracy is usually associated with atheism. And something that I notice that's really interesting when I speak with those who have a faith, like, you know, Christians, and to those who are atheists, I notice that Christians tend to have a little bit more of an open mind to deeper ideas and sacred sciences than atheists do. And something you said in your presentation about initiation, which I kind of talked about on my last show, it really struck me because I've had to deal with this, you know, people who are very resistant to these deeper ideas, and those who are more open-minded, but they've kind of chosen a faith. They're very religious. So that would typically be like Christianity. But in your presentation, you get into the history of secret societies, talking about how in order to be initiated into a mystery tradition, you had to join a faith, right? So, and you also said that the mystery schools would not consider anyone who was atheistic or unteachable, right, into the mystery schools. And that's something that I was hoping you could explain or elaborate on a little further, because I really find that very interesting.
You said yourself right there at the beginning that the Christians seem to be a little bit more open-minded than the typical atheist. And what you meant, I took that as what you meant by that was that they were more open-minded to spiritual concept.
Right. Yep.
So that makes sense because they've already accepted the idea of a creator, whereas an atheist has rejected the idea of a creator.
Right.
And it's important to point out that the ideology of atheism is a religion in and of itself. It's a belief system. So, you've already answered your own question in a sense that part of the reason that they're more receptive is because they've accepted the idea of spiritual possibilities. whereas an atheist is prepared to outright, rigidly, skeptically reject any spiritual prospect. And then in the ancient mystery schools, let's say the pre-Augustus or the pre-Christian era, the mystery schools were an essential function of the society. But that in order to enter into the mystery school, you had to have chosen a faith, which means that you had to openly admit that you have faith that there is a such a thing as a creator.
Right.
And what you can call God or what have you. But the idea was that there's a sacred body of law, and the purpose of the secret society is to flesh out and uphold the sacred body of law. So they have what's called the VSL. And the VSL is the volume of sacred law.
Right.
So whatever your chosen faith is as an initiate, when you come to the podium, you bring your volume of sacred law, and then we offer the tools and the implementation from antiquity to flesh out the deeper spiritual meaning of the sacred volume or the volume of sacred law that you've brought. So part of that concept is related to the fact that all of these faiths originally stem from something older. And the older knowledge is stored in the implementation. So what that basically means is for us to flesh out the esoteric meaning of the exoteric faith, we can't really do so without the aid of the implementation and the tools from the ancient mystery schools. And whatever your VSL is, it's respected.
Right.
And that's important because we all understand the prospect of a holy war could be biblical prophecy realized, and it is a real impending danger. So we have a responsibility to avert that. So we ultimately do need to reconcile culture. We ultimately do need to reconcile cultural epistemology. And I know most people that are interested in freedom and starting out on this journey probably aren't that far along, and many may never get that far along. Like I say, I've gone into the anthropology. I wanted to carry the torch of natural law into the darkness of antiquity and try to really reconnect with origins, because I feel that without that, we're cut off from truth and we're cut off from our elders of antiquity and an ancient body of wisdom that took longer to develop than any knowledge that we have left in the world. So that's a big part of the problem. We're talking about ancient wisdom. We're talking about a body of knowledge that took longer to develop than anything we have left. Now, most of what we have in today's world is built on that knowledge. It's built on top of it. But the foundations were squandered. So if we don't recover those foundations, we only have a partial knowledge.
Right.
For which we cannot take responsibility for, because we just don't have the means to possess it. We don't have the necessary temperament to deal with it. In other words, we will be destroyed by it.
Right.
It's similar to the allegory in the movie, animated film, Heavy Metal. That green orb, it kind of overtakes you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't have the spiritual armor to resist the power that you're wielding. It's very similar to that in the sense. And, you know, the idea of man's ambition and man's pursuit of power and ultimately man overthrowing the creator and becoming God. That's the big conundrum that we all have a responsibility to deal with. But part of what I was saying is people that are going into the freedom community or the freedom movement, they may never go into the anthropology. And I wouldn't say that that's absolutely necessary for everybody or even most people. But I would say that it's imperative for our better minds. Because if we don't understand what happened in the chronology of Egypt, we don't really understand any of the knowledge that we have in the world today, and we don't understand what the responsibility is having that knowledge. Because, you know, the way I say it is that we developed the lesser mysteries and the early Egyptian cults, but those were squandered and lost in exchange for pursuit of the greater mysteries, which gave us the power to wield the forces of nature. And that the original stellar civilization that built the pyramids held back the Aten because they knew it would give man powers of 10, and the powers of 10 would allow man to develop and dominate nature and develop physical technologies that deal with the physical mechanics of the physical world and can easily negate spiritual principles. So there's a lot to that, and I want to keep talking about it.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're talking about with regards to being able to, you know, go back in time and understanding anthropology with respect to the ancient Egyptian mythos. And this is something that I'm trying to convey with these tracing boards that I've been talking about in the past couple of shows on how we use these boards to we bring the knowledge that we learn about these boards. We bring them to these boards, and the board is the tracing board is the information. And as we bring knowledge to it, especially knowledge regarding the ancient Egyptian mythos, then it starts to reveal something to us about ourselves in the now. And I'm wondering if that is something that you would like to expand on, because I know you know quite a bit about the tracing boards.
Well, I was blown away when you were talking about it in your shows recently. I think you did a really good job explaining the significance of it, particularly that it could be carried in memory and then made portable in that way, and then just brought out and drawn and worked with anywhere you go. I thought that was very profound, because that gives us a means of carrying the knowledge in the book out of Egypt without having a physical copy.
Right.
That's part of the genius of it. That's part of the genius of the whole mythos in general, is that it is the key to our salvation, and it is the key to our evolution as a species, but also the key to how the knowledge was proliferated and survived into the modern world. Because we have to consider that it otherwise would not have. So we have to humble ourselves to the point where we at least respect the elders that endeavored to find ways for this knowledge to traverse through the course of time and survive all of this, the collapses of civilizations through history, and still emerge as recoverable in the modern world. Because if we can't recover it, we will not be able to stem this tide and divert this course. So the whole genius and the appreciation for what has taken place in the past, I think, should be about that. Because that's, if we don't understand that, then we don't really understand what they're endeavoring to do. They're not just endeavoring to preserve knowledge. They're endeavoring to pass knowledge forward. So there's an awareness that the knowledge could be lost. There's an awareness that the knowledge could be compromised. Now, why would that be the case? Because at some point, that knowledge is going to become hostile to new ideas. Or new ideas are going to become hostile to that based on man's ambition. So the whole idea is to create a contingency for man's ambition. And the respect that's due to the elders of antiquity is that they found a way to preserve this knowledge all the way into the modern world. Not enough scholars have managed to recover it yet to appreciate that, but the ones that have proved that that's the case. And I'm talking specifically about J. Norman Lockyer, Albert Churchward, and specifically Gerald Massey.
Yeah, all three amazing authors and very, very much recommended if anyone has not looked into their work. So, but yeah, this information that has been left for us by these ancient Egyptian elders is so powerful, and they have managed to not only understand these sciences, but then were able to store them somewhere that we can eventually come to understand in the future, just because these places in our universe, you know, especially the Polaris, you know, the Little Bear constellation, the information that is stored there is completely protected, and it's been protected for, you know, since the beginning, since, you know, the stellar people were able to store that information within this constellation to help us understand how to align ourselves with nature and be balanced. Because that's the other thing about the tracing boards that are what they're trying to help us understand about ourselves is equilibrium. Because equilibrium is all about bringing our imbalances into harmony, so that way we have a nice frequency that harmonizes with nature and doesn't go against nature. And that's what the constellation and that's what these sacred sciences do. And if we really take ourselves serious and we really want to, you know, not get into these big wars all around the world, taking this information serious is really what's going to help us have a better future for ourselves and for the children of the future and for the life of the earth. And it is so amazing that they have built these, well, you know, they discovered these sciences. They created ways of preserving these sciences in something like the zodiac so we can understand ourselves in consciousness and the ways in which we are able to harvest, you know, to know when to plant and when to harvest, you know, and how that corresponds
to balance.
To
maintain the balance.
Right. And how that corresponds with our consciousness is so brilliant. It's so amazing. And this is the science that people shoo away. No one wants this science that can actually bring us.
It doesn't have any utility.
Right.
The only utility that it has to offer is the survival of the human species.
Right.
And most people don't understand that. But if they did, they're not really interested in it. They're only interested in their own game. So that is an indication that they see life as one and out. And that is an atheistic prospect, and or that post-mortem they're traveling off to some other world.
Right.
So I think it's important to to put the emphasis on. There is no other world. There is nowhere else you're going to go. But it does take a lot of work, and it takes a lot of care, and that's what's lacking. I mean, the goddess is in exile, in rags.
Right.
So if you're looking for the goddess, you will need to stray from the Gospels, because the Gospels is becoming orthodoxy. So you will need to stray into the wilderness, where you may encounter Pan and all of that. It's part of the task at hand. And the whole idea of encountering Pan is just confronting the ego itself and knowing that the ego is going to try to deceive you and try to trick you to divert you off of the path in pursuit of the goddess, which is the care. And it's the feminine creative principle that we cannot exist or survive without. And there's a lot of different ways we can say it, but I think that came out pretty good.
I'm glad you brought up Pan. I was watching your presentation the other day, and you know, I picked up on this before, but man, the way that you describe Pan, if you want to, I'd like to hear you talk about it. But there was, I think you said something along the lines of Pan meaning to spread out, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, it's full range.
Full range, yeah. And then I started thinking, oh, okay, well, that makes sense where our pan on the fire comes from, you know, when you're cooking. So if you want to go ahead and explain a little bit about Pan, I think people would really appreciate that.
Well, it's an ancient Greek nature god, and basically it was depicted as a half man, half animal creature that you would encounter if you strayed too far into the wilderness. But it was a nature deity, and it ultimately became our archetypal image of our Christian devil. And that's my claim, that it ultimately, that is the source of our archetypal Christian devil, because I believe the devil card in A.E. Waite's tarot was derived from Pan, and then our image of the archetypal Christian devil was likely derived from that. But it's also derived from ram symbolism. I think that's probably the purest source of it. We have to understand how significant ram symbolism is, because it's one of the most ancient symbols. And at some point, it became hostile to new doctrines, or new doctrines became hostile to it. And I think the Age of Aries plays into that, where we could have put too much emphasis on the ram in the Age of Aries, just like we would put too much emphasis on Taurus in the Age of Taurus, or on the bull in the Age of Taurus.
Mm-hmm.
Those are factors, you know, so the zoo type phenomenon, it's so ancient that it's not understood. The knowledge of the zoo typology is definitely in peril. But what we have to understand is if new doctrines are threatened by more ancient doctrines, then they are endeavoring to marginalize and ultimately obliterate ancient doctrines. So we have to be careful just trying to throw any babies out with the bathwater. You know, we need all of the knowledge that we have to work with. And I got a little distracted from your original question there, but yeah, Pan is it's very significant, because to really fully understand it, we have to understand the situation with the Greeks. There is nescience. They do not understand the Egyptian. And what we have in the modern world, we inherited from the Greeks, because the Hebrews took from Babylon what was already a corrupted Egyptian, and they brought us the Torah from that, what we know as the Old Testament. And then the Greeks took from the Hebrews what was already a corrupted Babylonian account of a corrupted Egyptian, And the Romans took from the Greeks, and classical scholars passed that on into the modern world, or carried that into the modern world. So we, like I said, we have the same dilemma then as we have now. We do not understand the mythological mode of expression of the Egyptians. So if we scoff at that, that's basically our own death now. Because without that knowledge, personally, I don't think we can stem this tide. It's been the whole source of the dilemma since we strayed from the source of the original body of knowledge. So that's something that's very important to understand. And I've been wanting to try to say this. So let me try to say this. The three phases of the evolution of the Egyptian mythology are stellar, lunar, and solar. We have to understand that the stellar is the longest lasting, anywhere from 300,000 to 600,000 years, a lasting civilization that had tried socialism in its beginnings and abandoned it, never to return to it, because they had discovered that socialism only works in groups of 100 or less. So keep that in mind. And they had abandoned it, never to return to it. So the idea that the pyramids were built by slaves is totally a fallacy. The pyramids were built by an entire civilization that lasted longer than any other civilization in human history and was united in its task. And one of the most significant things to understand about that is that that civilization never did collapse. What happened is it moved into the lunar phase of the mythology. And when it did that, that constituted an advancement in the mythology, but at the same time, it constituted a departure from source. Mm-hmm. And then when we get to the solar phase, it's even a more of a branch off the branch of the departure from source. So we're straying even farther from source. And then past the halfway point, or at least, you know, somewhere in the course of the solar phase, we reverted back to socialism. And I want to just go ahead and point out here that, you know, that Babylon exists, or the original Babylonians were originally stellar. And that means that civilization is more than 150,000 years old. But that civilization was infiltrated by the later solar cult during Amen-Ra, which was a day sky prospect. And the corruption happened there. And I would say the socialism started there too, before it came back to Egypt. But ultimately, it was socialism and bureaucracy that caused the collapse of Egypt, and that happened in the solar phase. So in that respect, the stellar civilization never collapsed. And I think that's something that we have to keep in mind, and that's why I put so much emphasis on it. But because I think one of the things that's not understood is that bureaucracy and socialism is the cause of the fall of every great nation in human history. So let me say that again. Bureaucracy and socialism. Let me say it again. Socialism and bureaucracy are the cause of the fall of every great nation in the history of the human race. And because I've never heard anybody else say that, I have to think that people don't understand it. And when I say socialism, I mean any form of coercive government with centralized control. So this idea of capitalism is a facade. We've never experienced any such thing. And with centralized control of resources, we have no potential to ever experience such a thing. But, you know, at the grandest scale of understanding spirituality, we're here to help each other. So if anybody's trying to get a leg up, that's social Darwinism. And even a barter system would lead to social Darwinism. So I think it's a beautiful thing, because ultimately the spiritual lesson is we have to learn how to share and help each other.
Yep.
And that's a grand spiritual lesson. But at the same time, you know, through the discovery of the mystery schools, we can discover that there's a clear design on our liberty. And that is absolute 100% proof of an intelligent design. So if you can prove that there's a clear design on our liberty, which we've talked about, natural law, as morality declines, freedom declines, then there is no denying that there's an intelligent design. And that's one reason people have an aversion to it. They don't want to accept that because it completely uproots or is an upheaval for their own lifelong built paradigm that they've used to survive and interact in the world. So it's a tremendous threat to their very existence. So we have to keep that in mind when you're trying to reach people.
Absolutely.
And you can see I'm ready to keep going on and on about this, and that's not the point. I don't want to make it rhetorical, but I want to make sure that we get it explained as well as we can.
Absolutely. Kind of add in a little bit with Pan, because I liked what you said about the pandemic, right? Because it's being spread out. And anyway, when I heard about spread out, I also thought of the archetypal devil, as the archetypal devil has two horns. And how I understand the archetypal devil is that the archetypal devil has two horns because it represents being a part in dualism. And this being a part in dualism usually is, or more than likely, is about materialism. Because to be spread out like Pan, to be spread out, to have the poles spread out and not having the pillar of wisdom in the middle where the marriage happens between the two pillars, you don't have this middle, you don't have the erected middle pillar in the archetypal devil. And the archetypal devil is red, which is the base desire color. It's the root chakra color. And the devil is also goat footed, right? So it's really interesting how this has become a belief of people that something like this actually exists, but really it's just an expression to help us understand ourselves when we're in a materialistic mindset in the aggregate. And I thought that was something really interesting that I caught when you started talking about the spread as pan.
It's where we get our term demon, because that comes from pandemonium.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea of demonic comes from pandemonium. And there's a lot of things that we want to understand about it. Mostly that what we have is our imaginations run amok with things being stigmatized, and it's all a result of the corruption of the ancient wisdom.
Right.
But ideally, there's a lot of things that are profound about it, and it has to be understood. Like what you were saying, the pillars represent the polarities as widespread, as far apart from each other as they can be. You know, the absolute opposite of balance. It's total polarity on either side. It also represents the boundaries of the physical realm.
Right.
Where the devil would reign supreme through man's ambition. So first thing we want to make clear is that the idea of the devil is an ideology.
Right.
So, but we realize that people have literalized these things, and it's this literalization that constitutes our own devolution. So it's the loss of the ancient expression that we are perplexed by. And I want to read you a little bit of church word regarding that. Not trailing clouds of glory, we have come from any state of perfection as fallen angels in disguise, with the trump of attainment all behind us, but as animals emerging from the animals, wearing the skins of animals, uttering the cries of animals, whilst developing our own. And thus the nescient race has traveled along the course of human evolution with the germ of immortal possibilities in it, darkly struggling for the light, and a growing sense of the road being uphill, therefore difficult, and not to be made easy like the downward way to nothingness and everlasting death.
Wow.
So our purpose to evolve ourselves and create a higher type is a difficult task, much more difficult than the downward spiral or the downward path to nothingness and everlasting death.
Right.
Laziness, apathy, and cowardice are the adversary. And those are our spiritual, or time and attention are our spiritual currencies.
Right.
So the idea of taking the easy way out is taking the downward path to nothingness and everlasting death. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you just think of the gravity being symbolic. Because the pavement means base consciousness, right? The porch means base consciousness. And when we're, as I talked about on the last show with the spiral staircase, we are evolving up. We're transcending gravity symbolically. We're moving away from the gravitational base desire pull. The west direction, right, in the first degree tracing board. And we're moving up symbolically into the higher echelons of consciousness towards enlightenment. And it's that, you know, the gravity of our fantasies and base desires are what pulls us back towards the floor, and that's what we resist. We resist those things in order to find our higher self, to discover our higher self. And it's very interesting how gravity works both spiritually in a symbolic way and in a literal way.
Yeah, the spiritual is always reaching down to pull the physical up, while the physical is reaching up to pull the spiritual down.
Right. Right.
So another way we could say that is the frontal neocortex is reaching down to pull the R complex up, and the R complex is reaching up to pull the neocortex down.
Right.
And what we have to understand is there is no development in frontal neocortex of any significance unless both hemispheres are brought into balance. Now, that's a paradigm. It's a model. We don't have to literalize it, but we can literalize it because the brain is clearly divided in two hemispheres and three tiers.
Right.
So this triune brain model is imperative to understanding the ancient psychology. If you're not comfortable with the right-left paradigm or the triune brain model, then we can just change the terms because that's a paradigm. It's a model.
Right.
The terms then would be intellectual and intuitive, and those are different qualities. So we have to understand the idea that Jesus spoke in parables is not he's trying to riddle you into confusion. It's that you simply cannot learn to decode sublime information until you fully activate unused parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing in our Western education is addressing those areas of the brain. In fact, most of the programs are working and endeavoring to phase out the arts. So the idea of Jesus speaking in parables is knowing that the intuitive aspects of the brain have to be activated.
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's even just like green language. There really is no way to understand green language until you are finding balance within. And there's a lot of people that will dismiss green language but yet still use wordplay and puns and say it all the time. And the reason that they can do that is because there's a part of their brain that's activated that allows them to see what words are actually saying. But then there's this part of their logical skepticism brain that's saying, well, there's nothing to this at all. But see, then it comes to if you don't have an understanding of morality, because morality is the key here. When it comes to this middle language, and if we don't have morality, if we don't have an understanding of morality, then we aren't finding that middle place. We're not the middle frequency is not lighting up, and we are not in a alchemical wedding, if you will, right? So it's all about the balance. It's about the equilibrium.
That's correct. And everything the ancient Egyptians are endeavoring to do is achieve that balance on a spiritual plane, because they understand that that's the only way it can manifest in the physical plane.
Right.
And that is not understood in the modern world. So throwing out green language with the bathwater is a big mistake, because that is restricting the possibility of your brain faculty from being able to decode more information from something that becomes apparently exhaustible or mundane. And
exactly.
You know, for instance, each letter of a word is a symbol in and of itself. And you know, we can say the letter A is a blade. And that's a masculine prospect. And the letter E typifies the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn and the equator. And it stands for equilibrium or equator. So we have to understand that everything that the Egyptians endeavored to do was to bring that universal balance. And that didn't just apply to the physical terrestrial earth. The idea was that if we attain the balance on the terrestrial earth, that will order balance throughout the entire universe. That's the idea. So that starts on an internal level. And it's very profound when we look at the ancient tribes, because here's the deal. This is something that needs to be brought right into the light, and I'm going to try to do it right now. The ancient tribes in Egypt, when they did their ceremonies, they set up both pillars. And those pillars represent the South Pole and the North Pole, with the Southern Hemisphere representing the spiritual realm and the Northern Hemisphere representing the terrestrial physical realm. So it's very important to understand that when that moved into the North, that is the schism, because that kind of flipped the original mythos entirely on its head. So one way you could say that is the god of the North Pole deposed the god of the South Pole. And the danger of that is the North Pole is associated with masculine, and that's a physical prospect. So the idea of westing or primacy in the North is a masculine imbalance, a tendency to dominate the feminine, or the physical to dominate the spiritual. So that's what all of that is about. But let me start over. So the tribes in Africa, when they did their ceremonies, they always erected both pillars. Here's the interesting part. In the solar mythos, those were changed to constellations east to west and west to east. And then the deity known as Horus would typify the rising sun to high noon, or the day sky, or spring equinox to summer solstice. And then Set would represent fall equinox to winter solstice, or the night sky, the night realm. So in that respect, the golden falcon became the zootype to typify Horus as the rising sun, making his flight across the sky. And then the journey through the underworld at that point would be typified by the black bird, or the crow, or raven. Okay, so if we look at the Australian Aborigines, here's the interesting part. The Aborigines have two tribes. One is in the south and one is in the north. And when they do their rituals, each tribe only erects one pillar, because the southern tribe has one pillar, which is denoted by the... They don't have the black bird and the golden hawk. So the southern pillar is typified by the black cockatiel. And then the northern tribe has the other pillar. That's typified by the white cockatiel. So here we have the Egyptian ritual in Australia. And more importantly, we have the foundations of Freemasonry.
Right.
So this is the kind of antiquity that we're talking about when we talk about Freemasonry. And that the term Freemasonry is confusing, because that's not the term that would apply. This is the Egyptian craft. But this is what emerged, or the lodge systems known as Freemasonry had managed to preserve and recover and bring into the modern world to make accessible for us today, whereas otherwise I say we would not have it without the function of the secret societies through antiquity. That Rome had packaged and labeled the exoteric and went to war on the esoteric and the secret societies. So we have to understand that definitely demonstrates that what we find in Australia and the Australian hieroglyphs is purely Egyptian. And more importantly, what we know as the foundations of the tradition known as Freemasonry. So go ahead.
You were talking about something that I just was thinking about when you're talking about the white bird in the Aborigines, or with the Aborigines, and it reminded me of when you were telling me about the allegory of the white bat in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, when they're in Australia. So I was wondering if you could...
I didn't know that took place in Australia.
Oh, I thought it did, because... Well, maybe it... No, maybe it didn't. No, I'm thinking of the guys...
I'm not sure that they really specified where that was supposed to be taking place.
Right.
Like maybe New Guinea or...
Yeah, I don't think it's Australia. I was thinking of the guys who you know, took the blow dart and hit him in the neck, who kidnapped him. They were Australian, right?
I think that they were archetypally typifying Aboriginal tribes that would correspond to New Guinea tribes or Australia, but I'm not sure that they ever really specified which tribes those were supposed to be or that there was anything authentic exactly about those tribes. I think it was partly archetypal, but yes, it did invoke the Australian Aborigines or possibly the New Guinea Aborigines, but I'm glad you brought that up because that is the perfect example of what Julius Caesar did to master this art of divide and conquer. So what takes place in that movie is you have venture capitalists, industrialists wanting to industrialize and exploit the resources of that land, but they can't do so as long as those tribes are occupying that land. So the plan is to get those tribes to war with each other and then kill each other off so they can take over their land. And they do that by taking their sacred zoo type, which in this case was typified by the white bat and the black bat. And it means the same thing in that respect that the white cockatiel and the black cockatiel would mean in the Aborigine tradition of Australia. So it's a great example of how divide and conquer actually works. And it shows you. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because that is a great example. Both those movies have a lot of esotericism in it.
Oh, for sure.
But it's the second movie that I think is very profound because it helps us understand early Freemasonry. That these two tribes represented, you know, if we understand the Aboriginal tradition, we will understand that's Freemasonry. And one more thing I want to say about the Aboriginals of Australia that demonstrates a superiority to modern human is that they do not practice socialism. We are primitive by comparison in our ideology.
Right.
So we mock what we don't understand.
Right. You were kind of touching on spirit earlier and invoking spirit. That was something that I talked about in the last show, invoking the spirit as far as numbers. How do numbers invoke the spirit? And that's something that you have definitely talked about in the past that I think you do a really good job of breaking that down. And that was something in the last show in the middle or the winding staircase, you have the 3, the 5, and the 7. And I'm wondering if you'd like to talk about and what does it mean to invoke the spirit within numbers?
I'm thinking of that image of the tracing board that demonstrates all three sets of stairs. And we noticed in that image that they had the trivium out of order.
Right.
Let's just go ahead and clarify. First of all, the trivium in its purest form is Freemasonry. So entered past raised is the equivalent of grammar, logic, rhetoric, or knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. So the middle chamber is where we are learning to work with and apply the knowledge from the entered degree. And then the master degree or the raised degree is wisdom. It's the output. It's the accomplishment. It's the triumph over materialism. It's right action in the world. That's very significant because most important thing about understanding the numerology is to focus on the single digits. Understand that there was an earlier number systems that were based on the lower numbers because the numbers were discovered chronologically ordered. So we discovered the one before we had the two, but we could never understand the one without the two. And that's a discussion that will be ongoing. So in order for the one to understand itself, it divides into two, and that's where we get the three. And this corresponds directly to the ideas of these polarities and these pillars. So those are the most significant numbers. Ideally, one is the singularity, so that is the supreme. Everything else is a function of the one, or a part, an accessory part of the one. And with the odd numbers invoking the spiritual realm, the even numbers are going to typify the physical realm conversely. So that's very important, because understanding that the four represents the physical plane. So when we deal with the four directions, or the four seasons, or the four divisions of the zodiac, we want to associate that with the cardinal points, which are typified in the pyramids and typified in the ship wheel, and then the sabbats typifying the semi-cardinal points. So in order to understand the semi-cardinal points, we have to first understand the primaries, which are the cardinal points. Winter solstice, spring equinox, summer solstice, fall equinox are the four horsemen of the apocalypse, with pale horse as summer solstice. That's where sun begins to lose power. The beginning of waning angles is pale horse. And then, of course, black horse would be winter solstice, and red horse would be fall equinox, and white horse would be spring equinox. So the four is the most profound way to understand the correspondence of the physical to the even number. For instance, four-legged animals, an elephant may have been seen as the body representing the earth, and then the four pillars holding up the earth. That's just an example. But it was the four that would be significant there, because it's typifying the physical realm. And the idea of the Trinity, it's our source spiritual concept. So the original Trinity is Horus, Sut, and Shu. And that's purely Egyptian. And we will find corrupted forms of it. But main thing I'm saying is that's the original. And the fact that it's an odd number denotes a spiritual prospect. You know, I may not be able to fully explain that, because there's a lot of things I want to talk about, but let me just say this. The most important thing to understand, or what this reveals to us, is how to discern the greater mysteries from the lesser mysteries, and understand that everything that happened in the earliest civilization, which was stellar, was dealing with that number seven. So it's a safe assumption that there was a number system based on that seven, and that every number before the seven had been discovered before we arrived at the seven. So the five had a special significance. The Trinity gave us the three. The five was given to us by the family of Osiris, but that happened in the stellar phase. So that corresponded to the five extra days of a 365-day year. So that was seen as a 360-degree circle with five mysterious days added, and those days reserved for venerating those five mysterious spirits or divinities, which typify one divinity in five aspects. But the point is, the family Osiris did exist in stellar. But that's where our five is derived from. I would say that's the most profound significance of it. The idea in alchemy, with spirit raised and driven inverted inversely into the ground, I mostly associate that with alchemy or Neoplatonism, but I would say the concept is far older. But see, main thing is the ancient cultures would have been endeavoring to preserve the original ideas. So the concern would always be new ideas obscuring source ideas. And then the seven is derived from the transition of the six between the five and the seven. So we can't really understand any of these things without understanding the chronological significance of each new discovery. And that's part of it. But the main thing I wanted to say is that, you know, in the musical scale, the seven represented the completion of the scale. So that's constitutes achievement. And then six would constitute failure because it was failure to reach the highest rung of the ladder, so to speak. So, but the idea is that the scale starts over in the octave in a seven-tone scale. So the eight is the one. And the irony is the eight, the one is an odd number. So now the eight prospectively is an odd number. And then each number succeeding that correspondingly. So the nine is even, 10 is odd, etc. It gets confusing.
Right.
Yeah. And the reason I would say that part of that, you know, we also have to remember that the seven typifies the stellar mythos, and that the 12 ultimately typifies the solar phase, which came later. But in the musical scale, the 12 is the totality of all of the notes in the octave, and the seven is the pure scale, the harmony in the octave. Those are the harmonics, and that those harmonics order the universe. So our planetary ecliptics are harmonic belts of the frequency of the sun. So our planets orbit the sun in the harmonic belts of its own frequency, including the asteroid belt. So that's in a harmonic frequency. And but in the greater mysteries, just remember the 13 is the one, because the octave ends with the 12. So the 13 has the special significance as the one also. But the main thing is to understand that most of what the stellar priest class would have been concerned about is going into the greater mysteries and wielding domination, or the potential to wield power over nature. So the idea is, in the stellar mythos, they had discovered these forces in nature, but in the greater mysteries, we had the possibility to harness these forces in nature. And, you know, I was trying to say earlier, so I'm just going to go ahead and throw it in here. Just remember one thing that leads us into materialism is the need for utility. So the more we stray from our natural habitat, which is roughly not more than 15 degrees north or south of the equator, increases our need for utility. So the more we go into a hostile region of the north, we can't plant crops year-round, so that forces us into carnism. We can't survive without clothing or fire or shelter. Then that forces us into the need for utility, which forces us to take more resources.
Right.
So the whole idea is you're not going to achieve perfection in the physical world, but the idea is to give back everything that you take and try to strike this balance and minimum impact, minimize your impact. And that's an individual responsibility that we are supposed to be taught by the elders. Of course, we're taught the exact opposite, that we need to exploit every resource, and that every resource on this planet and everything that's on this planet is a resource for us to use for our own materialistic ambition.
Very well said.
I'm just kind of reviewing in my mind what we just discussed, because it seems like there was something else that you said that I didn't fully answer.
Well, I was talking about evoking the spirit within the odd numbers, and I feel like you did pretty well.
Well, the main thing is that just let's keep in mind that just like in the alphabet, the vowels invoke the spirit.
Right.
And there's seven.
Right.
A, E, I, O, U, W, and Y.
Right.
So that's part of the significance of the seven. But also, in the number system or the numerology, it's the odd numbers that invoke the spirit. But we have to understand there's a cutoff point, and that's at the number 7. So it's the odd numbers up to 7 invoke the spirit, and everything after 7, we have to be in equilibrium. If we're working with anything after in the greater mysteries and we're not in equilibrium, well, that's the reason for the world in the condition it's in today. It's a spiritual imbalance. It's a departure from source. Ultimately, it's a compromise of principles. So we left the lesser mysteries laying, or lost them in the sands of the Sahara because they became inconvenient. But that didn't just happen deliberately. That happened through neglect and straying from source. So I would tell you that the pyramid, the project of building the pyramids was the contingency for that, which means that the stellar people understood that the lunar mythos was coming and that would be followed by the solar. They fully understood what was going to happen in those phases of the mythology. So everything that they did was a contingency. I think the most important thing to understand about the building of the pyramids is that it is a contingency for going primacy in the north, which means the original mythology was based on the southern realm and then all transferred and stored in the northern constellation. So that has the potential to flip everything over on its head. And when you talk about, or when you hear people talking about how everything is the opposite or the inverse principle that the dark occultists used, that's what this amounts to. That's part of the reason that we can't understand or see through it, because we don't understand that the entire spiritual realm has been, there's been a polar shift.
Absolutely.
In the spiritual realm.
Right.
Not the physical realm.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, and if you don't have the understanding of the principle of correspondence, it's impossible to understand that science. And
I agree.
And it is really, it's already so complicating because of how far back it goes, but then to see how, you know, something can be southern but then also mean eastern, you know, or when something goes from south to north, like an ideology or a belief system, and then stays there for thousands of years, and you don't really understand how that works, and you don't understand, like we don't understand how, you know, the hemispheres of the earth correspond to the hemispheres of the mind, of the brain, I mean, and then we think of east and west as our right and left, but then we don't really think of our north and south as our left and right, because
that's correct. We've been that's conditioned. Very important, because the north and south are the primary,
right?
Those are the boundaries,
right?
And the southern is the spiritual realm, or corresponds or typifies, and the northern typifies the physical realm. So when we go into the solar phase, that corresponds to west and east. So the north becomes the western prospect, or the west becomes the northern prospect, and the east becomes the southern prospect. So the west becomes the physical prospect, and the east becomes the spiritual prospect.
Right.
And we have to understand that that's our three-dimensional world. And that's what this four is typifying in the cardinal points. So, yeah, that's part of confusion. So there's no question about that. That's important. And I think that you've explained it well there, and I'm glad you brought it up. But, yeah, the reason that that's confusing is that's part of the reason that I put the emphasis on recovering the lost history or the chronology. Because if we don't understand the ideas in the pure forms, then we don't understand, first of all, what was significant about them, and then second of all, the danger of those becoming corrupted.
Right. Yeah, it's so amazing how, see, and that's what I'm really trying to express with these tracing boards, is they're made, I mean, especially Josiah Boring really did an excellent job at his 3 degrees expressed with the Entered Apprentice, the Fellow Craft, and Master Mason degree tracing boards. And I really feel like that first degree tracing board is so strong, has so much in it, and it really does help us understand these sciences and these correspondences, especially. And it's so powerful once we really take this serious. And that's what I was trying to say about finding our care, because once we find our care and we really start to understand this science, we start to recognize our true connection to the elders who preserve this science for us to live by, to understand, to be balanced within by, and then harmonize into world. I know I sound redundant when I say this, but it's one of those things that is so misunderstood, and yet it has a simplicity to it if we really give our time and attention.
Yeah, I agree. I think what you're trying to say, or what I'm getting from what you're saying, is just remind me what you're talking about.
Well, I'm just explaining that these tracing boards that I've been going over, and especially Josiah Boring's expressions of these tracing boards that I've been going over in these past few shows, what I'm trying to say is they preserve this science that helps us understand the elders of the ancient Egyptian world.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. One of the things I was trying to say is I think that we can, you know, I think even the unbegun or the non-initiated can understand that the knowledge was squandered and compromised because it does not offer utility. So there's nothing in the spiritual wisdom that serves man's ambition. So that ought to help us understand part of the reason why the knowledge was compromised.
Right.
And then the significance of the knowledge itself is this is knowledge that we need to harmonize and survive and exist in this physical realm. But what's most significant about this body of knowledge is that this is the body of knowledge that took the longest in our human history to develop, and to develop the methods to understand and teach.
Right.
So that's what I'm trying to put the emphasis on, because main thing I'm trying to say is I think anybody can understand that if the knowledge doesn't have any utility other than our own survival as a species in this physical domain, most people in their materialistic ambition don't have any use for that.
Right.
And it's, you know, so it's a stray from source. It's a stray from truth. It's a departure from the creator.
Right. And it's
also ultimately a departure from the laws of nature.
Right. And it's so interesting. You know, you talk about inversion, right? How everything's just an inversion. It's all an inversion of the spiritual world. And when, you know, when I was talking about how the, you know, when you look at the first degree tracing board, you have the pavement, you have the earth, right? And the earth has a gravitational pull. And that gravitational pull is not just in what we can understand in the physical world through physics, right? But you see that there's an inversion of the spiritual by man, you know, getting in a spaceship and trying to find life on other planets. And because the truth is we're trying to go outward and we're not going inward. You know?
That's right. That's exactly the right way to say it.
And so as we continue to just, you know, put these rocket ships out into space, we are running away from where we should
truth.
Be. Yeah, we're running away from truth. And we're running away from where we really need to go, which is up in consciousness, in the self. So that's what the tracing board is saying. We're supposed to be going, well, in the tracing board, it's about going east, right? Because it's about going to the rising sun. It's about going to light, becoming enlightened, and raising yourself. And we're, instead of raising ourselves in consciousness, we're raising ourselves off the earth in a spaceship to who knows where.
Yeah, instead of a spiritual raising, we have a physical raising.
Yeah, and I'm not against the exploration of space at all, but where we're collectively putting all of our time and attention to is definitely not into the self. It's definitely into these crazy, you know, government funded, you know, rocket space programs.
Yeah, I mean, the way you said it, we're going outwardly instead of inwardly. I think that clearly defines the problem. So I've pretty much covered everything I wanted to come on here and cover, but I know I could cover a lot of it in a lot more detail. So I'll look forward to coming back on, maybe solo hosting a few shows and getting all three of us on here.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I think we're going to try to do that this December. We shall see. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show. And I mean, we have definitely covered a lot of really heady topics, very important topics. One thing I wanted to say also is if you are wanting to know any more of Douglas Martin's work, then you can go to the Cubbyhole website and it will be, you'll find more of his work under Douglas. Yeah, so more shows, presentations, and news can be found at cubbyhole.com. And also, please definitely make sure to not miss the next shows where I'll be going further into esoteric Freemasonry, especially in regards to the fellow craft and the middle chamber, especially. So I hope this was an inspiring and very thought-provoking episode for you guys. And if you have any questions regarding any of the topics for these shows, make sure to email me at cubbyhole@mail.com. That's cubbyhole@mail.com. Also, any donations are always appreciated, as any funds that are donated go directly to the Cubbyhole website and the upkeep of the website. So just hit the donation button on the website at the top, and it's pretty easy to navigate from that point. So, and thanks again to those who have donated so far. Okay, I'm your host, Nate Kapp. Thank you so much for listening, and keep in mind to do no harm, defend truth, and keep transcending dogma.